Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the additional sanctions imposed on Vladimir Putin's bank and his cronies, and speak with Kevin Platt, a professor of Slavic languages and literatures at the University of Pennsylvania, who has an article at the Huffington Post, Russia's Powerful Media Bubble. We will discuss how Putin has created an alternative universe that Russians inhabit and assess what impact Kremlin propaganda is having on Russians in eastern Ukraine and Russian minorities in the Baltic states of the former Soviet Union, what Russia calls the near abroad. Then we'll examine the growing movement for public and community banks like the Bank of North Dakota that was founded a century ago in the last Gilded Age as an alternative to plutocratic control of banking. Gwendolyn Hall-Smith, the executive director of the Public Banking Institute and the co-founder of Vermonters for a New Economy, joins us to discuss a bill in the Vermont Senate that would establish a public state bank in Vermont out of an existing state institution that has enormous grassroots support but is being subjected to intense lobbying from the powerful banking industry who have dominated the hearings. Then finally, we will look into the giant $45 billion Time Warner Comcast merger that the CEO of Time Warner Cable, Robert Rob Marcus, describes as a dream combination, which it certainly is for him, since he will receive an $80 million golden parachute for losing a job he has only held for 3 months. John Simpson, a veteran journalist and consumer rights advocate with Consumer Watchdog, joins us to discuss how executives who negotiate mergers are able to reward themselves so lavishly and whether this dream combination that will create a monstrous cable TV and internet monopoly will have the lobbying muscle to buy off antitrust regulators and the informational power to blunt public resistance to a corporate monopoly that is free to charge what they like for delivering increasingly lousy service. And joining us now is Kevin Platt, who's a professor of Slavic languages and literatures and graduate chair of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His books include Terror and Greatness, Ivan and Peter as Russian Myths, and History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Platt.
Thanks. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
And you have an article at the Huffington Post, Russia's Powerful Media Bubble. And it is so powerful, of course, that the Russian people are largely in an alternative universe, although it was interesting to read in the New York Times on Thursday an op-ed by Alexei Navalny, who is the Russian dissident under house arrest who ran for mayor of Moscow recently, one of the more prominent critics of Putin. He suggested in his article that the U.S. should target its sanctions on Putin's cronies and the Kremlin mafia. And he listed a bunch of people, Timoshenko, the Rotenberg brothers, Arkady and Boris, Yuri Kovalchuk, Putin's banker, Vladimir Akunin, president of the Russian Railways, and he mentioned the oligarchs, Abramovich and Usmanov, and the two heads of Rosneft and Gazprom. None of those last four were sanctioned, but the earlier names that I read were, along with a lot of others, going back to Putin's cronies from St. Petersburg, and most importantly, of course, the Rossiya Bank in St. Petersburg, which is Putin's own bank. So do you think this is going to bite?
Well, I think it's going to make people uncomfortable, but I'm certainly not an economic analyst or an economic historian. It's hard for me to make an assessment of what the actual impact is going to be for these people. I don't even understand personally what it's like to be a multi-billionaire. Like, how much do you care if, you know, one or two of your billions are cut off for a short while? But I think it speaks too to the very complexity of the situation with regard to economic sanctions against Russia. All of these guys are huge oligarchs who created their wealth through fleecing the Russian people by taking control of the privatization process or through raiding the former generation of oligarchs from the 90s who took control of the privatization process. They have immense wealth, but lots of that wealth, too, is invested in the West, is active in Western stock markets. I just don't quite understand what the effect on American markets is going to be, what the effect on their position in American economic life or Western economic life is going to be. I think it's a really complicated situation.
But the other prominent dissident, the chess master Kasparov, has said that Putin's afraid of banks, not tanks. Would you agree with that?
I think it's true, but I mean, once again, I'm not an economic analyst. I can't really. I'm not the best authority to talk on these issues. But the basic fact is that Western Europe is dependent on Russian gas. There's no way that anyone's going to cut those, you know, gas lines in a quick way. There is the possibility of, I know, making American strategic reserves available, making American export available of gas to Europe. But that all takes time to set up terminals, to set up new methods of distribution. And in the end, I think that it can actually make up for the, you know, Russian supply in totality. So there's a kind of basic energy dependence between the West and Russia, which can't actually be addressed through sanctions. Russia knows that. They know that the West needs Russia as much as Russia needs the West in order to maintain the sort of basic economic structure of the world. So I think there's a limit to what can be done with economic sanctions. But we'll see. Maybe it will have an effect. I wonder how quickly sanctions such as this would actually have an effect on the Russian people, because in the end, what's driving the entire matrix, I think, is the expectation on the part of Putin and his administration that, you know, a small victorious war, that, you know, nationalist frenzy, that a sense of being under attack from the West and therefore that the Russian people have to come together is going to raise his poll ratings and give him the popularity that he was beginning to lose already 2009 forward, then 2011, 2012, the protest movement. You know, Putin was on edge. The real question, I think, is will economic sanctions have an effect on the daily life of Russian people to the extent that they understand that they need to be part of an interconnected world? And I have no idea how long that has to simmer until there's actually a felt discomfort.
Again, I'm speaking with Kevin Platt. He's a professor of Slavic languages and literatures and a graduate chair of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His books include Terror and Greatness, Ivan and Peter as Russian Myths, and History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Russia's Powerful Media Bubble. So let's turn to your expertise on Russian language, culture, and media, Kevin, and talk about your article, Russia's Powerful Media Bubble, which has enabled, which is certainly Putin uses. He's basically destroyed all alternative media, and even the few little alternatives that existed are being closed down, and Navalny's under house arrest. His blog has been shut down. It had 2 million followers. The internet has been an alternative to Putin's almost total control over information, but it looks like he's even moving against that.
Well, it seems like the role of the internet has changed radically over the course of the past 5 years in Russia. I think that originally, you know, 10 years ago, when, you know, 15 years ago now, actually, when Putin first came into power, he understood that the key to controlling public opinion in Russia was television. And so his, you know, basic moves were to take over, you know, independent television, which had sprung up in the 1990s, and make it into state television again. So that by the middle of the 2000s, all television had been brought to heel and was only producing the, you know, basically approved brand of news. But he also, you know, at that time, I think he was interested in projecting to the rest of the world a sense of, you know, Russia is still an open society, that there is still the possibility of alternative news sources. I think it was also important for, you know, Russian elites. No one in Russia, I think, wants to rush back into the arms of a completely controlled information environment. So there was, I think, always within that earlier strategy, the idea that you were going to leave some print sources as independent news sources. You were going to, you know, leave the internet pretty much alone, because I think that the Kremlin viewed the internet as a fairly marginal information source for most Russians, 10 years ago at least. And of course, right, this fig leaf effect. It was, I think, important for the Kremlin to be able to point to its independent media, which was marginal and which was not televised, and say to people who came and criticized it, well, look, we've got freedom of information. It's a free country. We've got free press. We've got freedom of speech. I think that all changed because, on the one hand, the role of the internet changed. By 2010, Russia, like everywhere else in the world, was being thoroughly penetrated by mobile devices, so that you didn't need to have a computer anymore to be hooked up to the social media to be connected to alternative news sources. And the, you know, mobile devices and, you know, Facebook in particular, other social networking platforms were really important in 2011 and 2012 when you had these, you know, mass protests of the urban, young, sort of middle class of Russia against the perceived corruption and jury rigging and, you know, ballot stuffing of the Putin administration. That, I think, was a wake-up call for the Kremlin, and they, I think, very quickly started to mobilize themselves to take control over the Internet. They created a new ministry and new legislation that allowed them to shut down very quickly any website which is deemed to be extremist, and they have extremely loose and broad definitions which can be applied in very arbitrary ways to determine who is disseminating extremist information and who isn't. That's what was used in order to shut down Navalny's site the last couple of days, that his sites are extremist because they support a reconciliatory and non-military relationship with Ukraine. And then, you know, I think there's also a sense of probably nervousness in the sort of Kremlin media control group with regard to the free press in general. So that they have actually been working pretty hard over the past couple of years to rein in the few print and popular internet sources which provide alternative media in Russia. That process accelerated really rapidly over the course of the last 2 months or so, so that the one independent televised source, which was a largely internet and sort of also it had some cable distribution, television channel TV Rain, very minor source, actually. I think it had 20 million viewers at its peak, 20 million subscribers. That has been cut off from cable for a couple of months now, so that it's, you know, purely internet distribution, basically, within Russia. And it's also been cut off, therefore, from its advertisers. It's about to go out of business. It was just announced this week that it's being chased out of its facilities, presumably under the pretext that it can't afford to pay them. It can't afford to pay them because its revenue stream has been cut off. And then the several prominent semi-alternative news sources have been taken over and had their administrations and journalist staffs purged over the course of the past. So it really has been a story of clampdown, which has reduced what little independent media there was to silence within Russia. There really isn't anywhere else to go for independent sources except offshore. Many of the sort of international sites are also blocked, though, because they're also deemed to be extremist.
And, of course, there is the one newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, that's partly owned by Gorbachev, that he hasn't really gone after, probably because of Gorbachev, I would imagine.
Yeah, that one is still running, and it's an important source. It's fairly minor in terms of its overall audience. It's
right.
The opposition newspaper of choice, largely read by the sort of urban opposition intelligentsia. But that's the other peculiar story about what's going on within Russia, is the extent to which sort of liberal creative intelligentsia, the educated urban elites, who 3 years ago were, you know, they weren't unified in their opposition to Putin. There was, I think, a fair degree of, you know, differences of opinion with regard to the goals and tactics of the protest movement. But there was, I think, a fair sense of, you know, unified upsurge of protest. I was in St. Petersburg and Moscow a lot that year. I was actually living in St. Petersburg. And you had the sense that, you know, the cities, the full elite, the educated classes were pretty much unified in revolt against Putin. There's nothing like that sense now. Really now, the vast majority of what you read in the media and also what you see on social media is united in support of Putin. There are opposition voices like Navalny's, but they are a really small minority. There's a sense that this issue, Crimea, has really been a wedge issue of incredible effectiveness for Putin, which has brought a lot of people who were opposed to him 3 years ago around into the sort of patriotic nationalist fold. It's pretty surprising to me, and there have been a number of very surprising, you know, people that I know personally, who, you know, I would never have expected them to come out in support of this. And it's a complicated story. It's partly because I think what was driving the opposition movement was the same sense of historical victimhood that is driving, you know, the same sort of base of emotion, right, that we have been crushed by our recent history. We are victims. 3 years ago, that rage was turned against Putin, rightfully so, as the major figure in charge of the victimization of the Russian people. But Putin has very effectively, through the image of an outside enemy, a corrupt West, an anti-Russian Western coalition, has managed to capitalize on that same sense of victimhood. And many people have bought the bait, decided that, in fact, the most important enemy is the external one, not the internal one. And they've banded together in that camp.
Well, we're not foreign to that kind of manipulation by our government here in the United States. We had, the Bush administration and the neoconservatives cooked up this whole war against Saddam Hussein, which, of course, the only winner in that war has been Iran, a complete catastrophe. But I recall at the time the entire press was on board, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, all of our loyal opposition caved in and voted for this bogus war.
You're right. You're absolutely right. It's a similar situation. Although when you say all, I think there are shades of all that we have to talk about. There really is very, very, very little space for any kind of opposition activity, opposition voices in Russian society right now. There have been protests which have gathered together, you know, many people in Moscow. The estimates range from, you know, the absolutely bogus underestimates of the security forces. I think they said that there were like 10,000 people at the protest last Saturday in Moscow of the Kremlin line towards Crimea. And 70,000 was the estimate that I heard from some opposition sources. That is a serious opposition. But still, there's a sense in the sort of public media that I can read, even in talking with people, or reading email from them, that people are being careful, that they feel like they are under attack, that there is no room for dissent in this society. In Putin's speech on Tuesday, when he announced the annexation of the Crimea, he was using extraordinarily scary language with regard to not just the external enemies that the nation was facing, but to enemies within. He referred to the danger from fifth columnists within Russian society. So, and there have been, you know, various columns in the course of the week talking about and, you know, branding various liberal opposed figures as traitors. There's one that I read actually just this morning about Navalny. The society, I think, is teetering on the edge of a very sort of dangerous witch hunt mood with regard to its opposition. Let's hope that it doesn't go in that direction.
So you'll have a house of un-Russian activities, do you think?
Yeah, it could easily come to that.
I don't mean to make these analogies with the U.S. because there's clearly no comparison between the lack of personal freedom and
there are enlightening comparisons, of course.
Yeah,
and I think that it is important to remember that the Iraq escapade was a completely bogus war that was carried out for different reasons than the ones that were announced and that did not receive the, you know, correct airing in American society.
Sure.
But I think it's a slightly different situation than what we're facing here.
Oh, of course. But let's just, in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to talk to you about, I spoke yesterday with a scholar on Ukraine, Taras Kuzia.
Yeah, I listened to your interview with him yesterday.
Oh, you did? Oh. And he was saying, for example, that there is a free Russian press. It happens to be in Ukraine. So I want to get a sense of the near abroad, the people that Putin's appealing to, saying, you know, he wants to sort of, you know, not, I don't know whether he wants to thinks he can reconstitute the Soviet Union, but appealing to the Latvians, the Estonians, and Lithuanians and Ukrainians of Russians in those countries. But that was one of the things that he said yesterday, was that there's actually free press in Ukraine, and that's the only free Russian press. So which direction is it going in? Is Russia's propaganda going towards these people, these minorities that allegedly they need to rescue from fascists and anti-Semites, or the other way?
First of all, there's not really great data about the media consumption of the Russian language populations in Eastern Europe. And I would love to get my hands on that kind of a data set, because it would be very interesting to see who, first of all, does a Russian speaker living in Riga, Latvia, or in Kharkov, who do they read? Where do they go for their information? I suspect that they read both Russian sources and local Ukrainian sources. That seems to be the case for the people that I've worked with most closely in this part of the world, which is in Latvia. Latvia has about a 26% ethnic Russian population and about 10% more Russian speakers, people of various ethnicities who grew up speaking Russian. That's actually the largest, proportionally speaking, Russian and Russophone population of any post-Soviet state in Europe, more than in Ukraine. Ukraine is a very different kind of situation, though, because Ukrainian and Russian are very close languages, one to the other, and almost everyone in Ukraine is bilingual. There's also a street language, a dialect, maybe it's a separate language, which is halfway between these two languages. So it's a very different situation in that pretty much everyone in Ukraine can read both the Ukrainian press and the Russian press. It's hard to know exactly where they are getting their information. It's not just a question, though, of who you're getting information from, but whose narrative you're buying and how you filter that information. You know, what's going on with regard to Crimea, for instance, is as much a story about, you know, what facts you're paying heed to and you know, giving credence to, as it is a story about what narrative you're buying. Is it a narrative about the accident of fate that unjustly made Crimea a part of Ukraine and that rendered every Russian in the Crimea a victim of the collapse of the Soviet Union? They rightfully should have stayed in Russia, and somehow they went to sleep in one country and woke up in another, as Putin said once again on Tuesday. Or is Crimea a part of a vibrant multi-ethnic society that has been for years a part of the Ukrainian state and one which is, you know, legally and according to all norms of international law, a part of sovereign Ukrainian territory? These are very different kinds of stories. And the question is really not just, you know, which facts, because the facts can be the same, but whose narrative you're buying into. Russia, the Russian media are projecting extraordinarily loudly with extraordinary authority, the first story that I articulated. And the question is the other story being articulated loudly enough, clearly enough, and with enough sort of compelling force in whatever other sources of information people in Ukraine are having access to? That is an unequal fight, because Ukraine is, of course, a much freer information field than Russia. It does have a free Russian media, but it also has a very cacophonous Russian media. There are a lot of different voices in Ukraine, and there is right now, I think, a very shaky sense of unity with regard to the political spectrum in Ukraine, with regard to attitudes towards the new Ukrainian government. I think there's a lot of distrust for the newly formed Ukrainian government because it includes a lot of the former elites who were associated with past Ukrainian governments, which have not really served the Ukrainian people well. So it's an unequal battle between a very loud and very consistent, very well-controlled media machine with a very compelling story about national victimhood and just retribution versus another story which is somewhat confusing, based in legal niceties, which are in and of themselves even not the most compelling terms for many post-Soviet people. The sense of national boundaries and legal institutions is not incredibly, you know, well supported by the biographical experience of post-Soviet people in Eastern Europe.
Well, Kevin Platt, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Kevin Platt, who's a professor of Slavic languages and literatures and graduate chair of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His books include Terror and Greatness, Ivan and Peter as Russian Myths, and History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how Vermonters are pushing for a public bank in Vermont.